You've stopped in at the Guidepost, brought to you by the American Saltwater Guides Association. Stock up on gear, grab a coffee at the counter, and get ready to hear incredible fish stories from the best captains on the East Coast and thought-provoking conversations with stakeholders and policymakers working to protect these fisheries. This podcast is presented by Costa Sunglasses.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome back to the Guidepost. I'm your host tonight, Captain Ray Jarvis out of Westport, Mass. And my guest tonight doesn't really need any sort of introduction except for the fact that he's a fishy guy, he's an entrepreneur, he's a great dad, and he's a good friend of mine. Captain Mike Hogan is our guest this evening, and excited to learn a little bit about the history of Hoagie lures, where they came from, you know, where they are today, and how Mike has kind of tailored his business to help the fish and kind of preserve the fisheries that we all enjoy. So without further ado, Mike Hogan. Mike, how you doing?
Ray, first of all, thank you so much for having me on your show here. I've heard your first couple so far, and they're awesome, and I don't really need an excuse to talk fishing with you because we do that often. But
yep,
you know, again, thanks for having me. This is certainly an exciting time of year, June, right? I'm here in the south side of the Cape, so
yeah,
in the same shooting range as you. Super excited right. about these striped bass popping the squid.
Yeah, it's a good time of year.
Season, but yeah, super excited to be here. Super excited to have striper thumbs. You can't see in the camera here, maybe, but and you know, my garden starting mostly. Got assaulted by a vole of all things, and
oh boy,
kind of feeling like Bill Murray from Caddyshack. I've been doing some unmentionable things out in the back trying to solve my gardening situation. But all things considered, great June. Happy to be here and happy to talk fishing.
All right, yeah, we're happy to have you, and you know, excited to get a little bit of insight into you know your world and how you kind of spend your time on the water and what you focus on and how you've kind of come to be today. You know, I know you were a guide back in the day. And from what you've told me over the years, you know, Hoagie lures kind of came out of necessity, almost like something like you wanted certain lures in your hands and you started to kind of come up with ideas and develop those ideas.
Yeah. So a lot there. I would say the lures themselves.
Yeah.
Came out of necessity in the sense that, you know, I had very particular ideas on how I wanted a larger soft bait to swim, certainly rig easier. You know, at the time, a lot of folks were, you know, literally sewing hooks into, you know, large soft baits. And with sort of my guide mindset, you know, that's a little hard to do on the water. That's something you got to do. It reminded me a lot of tying flies in my fly guiding days. And, and I'm also a tinkerer. So, you know, one thing led to another. So I'd say the lures were designed on purpose. The business happened by accident. You know, when I first started hand pouring the lures, it's really a simple process. Anybody could do it. You know, they're made the short run molds. They're made out of these little silicone molds. And I was literally melting plastic in my kitchen in the microwave and hand pouring them. And so the beauty of that is I could sort of tinker and tweak the molds just the way I wanted them, get the, you know, the plastic and the rigging just dialed in. You know, at the time, the Elizabeth, so this would have been around when I first started making the baits around 2004. And I'd been all growing up, you know, an avid angler since I can remember, probably just before I could formulate a complete sentence. And I think it was fourth grade for Easter. My mom gave me, this would have been the 80s, a make your own soft bait kit.
Wow.
Where, you know, that it's like, you know, times are different in the 80s, but you know, you're like melting. I was like melting plastic in a microwave in the basement.
Yeah, nothing wrong with that. Wicked safe.
Melting them on the frying pan up in the kitchen. Yeah. And it was amazing. So you pour, and then there was instructions on how to make your own mold of plaster of Paris. I was doing all that. I was totally unsupervised. It's funny. I look at my kids who were in fourth grade not that long ago. I'm like, oh my gosh. And so anyway, my soft bait history goes way back. But I was fishing down the Elizabeth Islands, and back then, you know, you're around sort of the 2004 through 2006, I would call the, at least in my lifetime, the pinnacle of striped bass.
Yeah, absolutely. Where,
and so it was awesome. And my favorite, I mean, still my favorite, it's less, productive now, but I used to love going down the Elizabeth Islands and, at nighttime, I had a 18-foot maritime skiff, and I kept it behind Shuckers and Woods Hole. I had the windshield taken off so I could like sneak under the bridge at low tide. I'd be pushing myself. I once got the boat stuck. Like, I was so tight, my compass in the boat, the maritime skiffs are really buoyant. And like, I pushed down, it came up, and I had it stuck. My compass got like stuck against under the bridge. I had to let the tide go out before I was like stuck under the bridge.
Just by your compass.
Yeah. And so I'd go down the Elizabeth Islands, the little FM radio, I'd listen to the Red Sox game. I'd be by myself. I'd have, I don't know, four, maybe five hoagies in my pocket, a spinning rod, and a tandem rig them, and a couple of rigs. It was just so simple, right? And I'd go down the islands, I had my favorite spots, but it was just like freshwater bass fishing, which I did a lot of growing up. I was, being in the Bassmasters and all that stuff. Just the usual stuff, looking for ridge lines coming down, boulders, eddies behind, textbook structure stuff. And I would just throw the big baits at night. If it was daylight, they'd be white. If it was nighttime, it'd be black. That simple. And the squid rips, I do pink and amber. And so I was guiding at the time too. And so it was one thing pre-rigging baits for me to go down the islands by myself at night. Mm-hmm. But it was another thing when you have two or three anglers on your boat, pot of bluefish go through, and you could very easily go through seven or eight soft baits in a matter of 20 minutes. And the fastest I got with stitching which was an amazing, I think it was, I credit Steve McKenna, very clever process for sewing the hooks in, but it was just simply put time prohibitive for me in the field to be doing that on a charter. And, I had a lot of groups of three, and so we put that hook slot in. I actually got a patent on that design. And so that's sort of how the hoagie happened. And then we got into business. Here in town, we have Eastman Sport and Tackle. Been buying tackle from Eastman since, I remember going in there on my like seventh birthday. Jim Young was still working there at I think then it was called the Tackle Box. And he gave me a Gibbs lure. It was like a spinner. It was a strange one-off Gibbs lure. And so that's how far I go back. So they hung them on the shelves. I was just had a kick seeing my name on a package on the wall. Then M&D's in Wareham back then. Mm-hmm. That was sort of another legacy shops. Oh, yeah. Red Top. And that was sort of it for a while. Just the three shops that were in my immediate radius.
So just to stop you there, when right around that time, I remember when you first kind of came out with the baits, I was working at Dockside Bait and Tackle in New Bedford on Pope's Island.
Oh, yeah, I know.
Yeah, and that's where you and I first crossed paths. I think I was 2004. I was probably 20 years old at that point, maybe 19. But I remember you coming into the shop and kind of like giving us some samples of your soft baits, and that was my first intro to you and to your original soft plastics back then. And it was funny, right from the get-go, I fished the heck out of those. You gave me a bunch of amber ones to try out, and I fished those on some flats that I, would hit seasonally right around like early mid-May, and it was crazy. It was like an eye-opening experience for me. There were sluggos around and stuff, and I had tandem rigged a lot of black ones for night fishing. And, I have always kept it simple as well with white and dark colors and night and day. But just your soft plastics were kind of like just an eye opener for me and super easy to rig. So I remember that well. And it's funny that, you know, we kind of got to know each other again a few years later on and have done a lot of fishing since. But yeah, that's my little spiel on your origin there too, during that time frame.
And that's really the best part of the whole gig. And we're in different parts of the formula, right? You're a full-time guide and I'm a full-time lure guy. But it's so, this is my 20th year doing this.
Wow.
It just snuck up on me. And the best parts of all the everything, it sounds cliche, but it's like all the awesome people and the funny stories and the memories. And, you know, at the end of the day, I feel like that's why many of us fish is the
everything
that comes with it. And I literally remember going in there, feels like yesterday. It's crazy. And
yeah, I can still remember it clearly.
Wow, that's trippy. I haven't thought of that in a long time.
Yep. So, yeah, so, you know, you kind of started there with the Hoagie Originals, and obviously, you know, those were effective. And over the years, you've come out with a lot of different products for your line. And, you know, I've always really liked the fact that you keep it relatively simple with everything. You know, it's catching fish, not fishermen. And, you know, you're like fish simple mentality. It's just, you know, there's a lot of stuff out there that can complicate the whole thing for people. But you've always kind of played it pretty straightforward and kind of matter of fact, as far as, you know, just presenting stuff the right way. And, you know, a lot of the stuff is simple colors and more about silhouettes than anything else. And that's why I really like the line. It's just simple fish catching products.
Yeah. I appreciate you saying that. And Fish Simple, Fish Mart, Fish Simple is like literally our slogan. And it's funny, we started there and we're very, very much now. And it's funny, if you hear me do other talks, I talk about, you know, sometimes I'll do some podcasts and talks about like the business side of things.
Yeah.
And I always say, I've made every mistake in the book, like at least once, usually twice, but never three times. And you know, I probably made a lot of mistakes more than three times, but that's too embarrassing to admit. But the so I started there. Then over time, I would say the middle teens, yeah, I had some gear bloat. So right now, for example, we have 400 and we'll call it 50, but it's not that many SKUs. That means stock keeping units. That's like, you know, a 10-inch original bone. Mm-hmm. Is a single stock keeping unit. 10-inch original black is a second. And so I would say it around by year 2018, and we started in 06, we had, I think it was 1,600 SKUs.
Wow.
And so we did get a little crazy with gear bloat. And we had, you know, we had more colors. We had a few more product designs. So it was a lot of, there's a lot of adjacent stuff that like certainly was fishy and certainly caught on. And it's funny, it right around that time I was, three things were going on. My kids were getting just old enough to ski.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a very seasoned skier growing up, but I'd gone like 20 years without skiing. So like I knew how to ski, but I didn't know like the program. The program in 2018 was a lot different than the last time I went skiing in 1994, say.
Right.
And I used to garden a lot with my mom, but I took that up, vegetable garden. I have like a mini farm in my backyard. I'm super into that.
Yeah.
And then I got involved with an MIT like product program, and all sort of like the same time, right around 2018. So I don't know if you sort of grew up around gardening, but if you try to figure out what fertilizer to buy, it's like astounding. You'll go in the Home Depot or wherever, your Eastman's, my little hardware store. There's just so many options. So like, if you look it up, how to grow tomatoes, like one thing will say, do it, whatever you do, do it this way. And then the next thing will, and there's just so many gadgets and gizmos, same with skiing. Yeah. Kids, and it's funny, I like my first time out with my kids, but none of us had helmets. Now the helmets are everywhere in between in those 20 years that I went. But like all the stuff I didn't know, I was sort of learning from scratch. And it was amazing to me how much stuff there was and how many things to think about. And it sort of hit me once when I was going to go on a film shoot with Sean, you know, Sean Ruge, my friend John Burns, and I had a blew an impeller in my 40er.
Okay.
And so we brought the 40er back in, had all my gear, because when I film, I bring like a little of everything, right? Because I don't know what I'm going to count, you know, it's like camera guys.
Right, you got to be prepared for any opportunity.
And so the switch from my boat to Ruge's boat was like three pickup trucks worth of crap. And I joked, I'm like, you know, I remember when I first started Hoagie, I would have like my whatever fit in my pocket was like what I would go with. And if I like ran out of lead material, hooks, whatever, that was like end of trip. Like I call it a day. I caught more fish doing that, I feel like. That was also a different time for striped bass. But anyway, and so it dawned on me, this is what a guy with his kids or a mom with her kids, you know, is like experiencing when they take up the sport for the first time. I'm like, this is insane. And then I was joking with Sean and my other friend John on the trip, like, you know, like we bring all this stuff, but you end up using the same like five lures. If you look at all my videos, it's all the same like 20 lures, not necessarily size and color, but and that the program I was in at MIT was all about like simple, functional, like not multitask, but task unification, system stuff. And I'm like, screw this. This is stupid. And I don't know how it happened. It just did. I was always a minimalist person. I'm a minimalist angler now. But so there was a period of time. And I swear I catch more fish with the less gear I bring on a trip. It's funny. I own a lure company. Yeah. I'm like, buy fewer lures. You'll catch more fish.
But, or just simplify your approach, you know, like rather than having all kinds of different colors and this and that, just like a more simplified approach to it all.
And I'm building a fishing like platform, and literally the last part of the equation is the lure, right? And, you know, being in the right place at the right time is like the most important part. Yeah. And knowing how to position your boat and where to stand, so to speak, is the second most important. And then once you get those first two right, the lure is obvious.
Yeah.
And it's usually something simple.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good point. You know, there's a lot of, you know, attention that gear and like, you know, the right rod, the right reel, the right line, the right lure, having all these different options of colors and, you know, the latest, greatest lure. But, you know, a lot of stuff that's overlooked is, you know, understanding patterns, being in the right place at the right time, like you said, which involves, you know, understanding seasonal patterns in fish and tides and water temperatures and things like that, that all, I think, get overlooked quite a bit. You know, everybody's, when they get into it, they overcomplicate it on the gear side and think a little bit less about the, like, ecological side, you know, just understanding the environment that you're getting into and how to interact with it and be the most productive you can while you're out there.
The thing I'd add to that too is I'm finding over time, increasingly so, it might be that on-demand culture where we all live in, where, you know, everything's at a scroll up or down or left or right with your thumb. People are very report focused.
Oh, big time.
And yeah, I think a lot of times that, well, one will get you in a big fleet of boats, which is less fun. And there's fish other than in the big fleet of boats. And number two, like your reports are old information. So if you have local knowledge about sort of the, you know, the migrational patterns and what's appropriate in your area, and to your point, the ecological factors, you know, wind, weather, tide, you know, like pressure changes, just basic knowledge there. And so if you know where they should be, why they should be, and what the weather is, and then the third one is like reading the water, right? You know, understand details. Simple ones like big birds, big birds, little bait, little stuff like that. A veteran might take for granted, but someone new to the game may not know something that simple. But, you know, that's it. And, you know, people... It's funny, I noticed that with gardening early on, I had a tendency to solve problems by throwing money at gear. I knew enough about skiing where I didn't do that. But as you watch, you go to a ski shop at a mountain, you'll see it like a mile a minute.
Oh, yeah.
And not only is that not a good use of your money, I think it makes the problem worse. You get all kinds of type 2 errors. And like, so you're rotating through lures and your lures are getting stranger and stranger, where you like you had it right the first time, you just weren't at the right depth, or you weren't at the right speed, or you weren't at the right color. You know what I mean? And right. And if you're changing everything too frequently and not understanding why of anything, you're just gonna maybe get lucky, but maybe not, and it's gonna be random.
And yeah. That's not angling. So there's like, you know, growing up, I played some golf, and some guys would always say, you know, to get better with a certain club, go out there and play an entire round with one club. And, you know, you learn that club and how to hit it in a bunch of different ways. And I can say the same thing about certain lures, you know, going out on the boat and spending the whole day throwing a weightless soft plastic, or, you know, a top water plug, whatever style that may be, or going out and doing like, you know, some bottom fishing or looking for bass holding in deeper water, and, you know, different jig approaches to them. Just spending more time focused on one tactic really kind of goes a long way, and ultimately kind of simplifies your thought process when you get out on the water and you see certain situations. You can kind of have confidence in an approach, but understand how that approach may work in a bunch of different kind of scenarios.
It's funny you say that. I'm reading David Epstein's new book, you know, The Power of Constraints. He's the guy that wrote Range and the Sports Gene. And the whole book, it's funny, it just came out a few weeks ago, not months. And his whole thesis is, you know, going back in time with innovations, like everything, too many options and too many different things has a very high correlation with lower performance. And more constraints, ironically, despite being counterintuitive, you know, increases performance. Like when he goes from art to to science to math to business, like examples all over the place. But it's funny. So what you mentioned with that single lure throughout the whole thing, I always loved those one fly tournaments in the Keys for tarpon.
Oh yeah.
To me, that's sort of the pinnacle of like minimalism.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, some of the best anglers I know, you get on their boat or you fish with them, and it's, you know, whether they're fly or spin, it's simple, and it's a repetitive kind of approach. And you know, they've spent the time and they have the confidence to fish certain things, and they fish what they trust and what they've had good experience with. But you know, the best anglers out there, they just kind of have a dialed program, and it's not over complicated. And I don't know, that's, again, just coming back full circle to Hoagie Lures, that's what I like about your stuff and how you've kind of developed over time. It's just you know, even going on your site, you can't really overthink it too much. There's some color options, but you know, there's certain baits for certain scenarios, and it all kind of just makes sense. And plus you have your playbooks for really simplifying a lot of that information for people, which, you know, having a look at those, and I've looked at them over the years, and I'm sure a lot of other people listening have, and it kind of shows you that boat positioning, or the bird factor, or which way the tide may be going, and how to set your boat up properly, and how to fish certain lures properly in those situations. So, you know, those playbooks are very helpful as well.
Oh yeah, thanks for saying that. We put a lot of work. We're actually coming out with a new edition in the next couple of weeks, but yeah, a lot of work goes into those. It's funny. I've been doing a lot of fishing writing, and it's really rewarding to write about it versus just knowing it. It's funny, your brain can like skip over stuff it doesn't know, sort of like AI, how you get like the slop from it. It just fills in the gaps with stuff. It's funny I've learned more about writing about fishing than like, I've learned more about fishing from writing about fishing than like actually fishing in recent years. Cause it forces you to like really understand like the physics of it and what's going on. Cause you got a lot of moving parts. You got wind, you got tide, and they can go with each other, against each other, you know, fish, you know, there's usually some sort of structure. A spot's not a spot. with just because it has a name. It's usually some sort of structure that's holding an entire ecosystem with how water is distributed about it or around it in simple terms. And just understanding how all that works in 3D is super important. And once you understand the 3D, the physics of, you know, saltwater fishing here, you know, how it's all going, like at a rip, for example, to me, you know, I was at Middle Ground the other day, it, I was reminded how much striped bass behave like trout in a stream, where they stand behind like a little like hump in the rip and they just lay in ambush waiting for a herring or a squid, in the other day's case, to sort of wash by and come up, especially the big ones. They'll just sort of hunker in their positions. You know, and understanding that is obvious why you want to stem the tide, cast up tide. And then as you work your lure, it's going to enter the rip horizontally, look like a squid trying to like swim out, but it's getting sucked in. That's more natural. You see a lot of people cast straight back into the rip where you see the fish, which right. is intuitive because that's where the fish is. But if you lead the fish with your lure and have it flow down, because you understand in 3D why they're aligned in the rip, you're going to get the bigger ones by having a more natural presentation with a big bait. Because if you look at the bait, they're trying to, they know it's lined with striper, that's the gauntlet, and they're trying to not get pulled through it, and they come in sideways. And so just that simple adjustment of casting here versus there, same lure, but a big change in outcome.
Yeah. That's definitely a good point there. And you've been on the rips recently. I saw you put out a video recently fishing down by Monomoy, and I, you know, personally, like, it's kind of my favorite time of year. I love all parts of the season, but, you know, fishing the rips when the squid are on there, and some of those rips are so shallow and you get to see the whole feed going on. You get to see the squid airing out of the water and the bass chasing them, and, you know, the gulls coming down and picking squid out of the air, basically, when they jump out. It's just a really unique kind of time in the season that we have, and it's super exciting for me.
Yeah, it's the best. So yeah, we were at Handkerchief. It's funny, the bass were behaving a little different then, but this time of year the water is like still quite clear, and yep. we were seeing like tufts of ink drift by the boat. It's like, you know, like, well, oh, wow. something happened up. Yeah, and it was really neat. I got some of that on film too, but yeah, it's funny. It reminds, you know, again, like, you think you have it all dialed in. You know, I showed up ready to run the Stem the Tide program. And oftentimes early in a tide, the fish will be way up front, or late stage in the tide, they'll be way up front in the smooth water. Mm-hmm. But the other day they stayed in front of the rip. I'm going to call it 300 feet, 500 feet, more, wow. 600 feet, way up in front. They do that at, you know, some of the spots we fished at too sometimes, but they
we've seen the same thing.
And they were definitely fishing the rip, smaller ones in the rip, and a lot of boats in the rip. But the beauty of fishing out front, and we sort of figured that out, is because it was just myself and Matt Rissell, the camera guy. So when he's filming, it's effectively just me fishing by myself. Yeah. And once we figured out that was going on, it was great. We went way, way, way up. Killed the engines and would make these big, long, easy, chill drifts. Now, you could see fish rolling out of casting distance. You could have run and gun if you want, but it was unnecessary. In fact, mm-hmm. like, the fish were a little spooky if you're putting around, but if you just killed the engines and made long drifts, it was like, and we were tonguing huge fish. And it was just very relaxing. And it's funny. And that came from just reading the water, paying attention, and having a very high distaste for bumper boats, lots of other, and that it was delightful. And a few other boats saw the same tells that we saw and joined us, and it was really pleasant because everyone sort of understood the program, right?
Right.
And we didn't have any bad actors, and, you know, just nice long slow drifts. Everyone, and the key too is not how you position, but it's how you reposition. And everybody was idling up nice and slow because, you know, it's the water skinny there, right? Right. And lots of the boats charging would have, like, the harmonics from that and the change of RPMs would have disrupted. So it was my first film of the year and first, like, serious fishing trip of the year. And it was, you know, it's funny. I feel like I should, like, take a break. It was so delightful. But it was a great trip.
That's good. Yeah, it's good to have a good day like that. And it's always nice to kind of get away from the crowd a little bit, too. You know, even on some of these crowded areas like you know, the rips or other areas where we'll see fish throughout the season, even offshore, you know, everybody kind of tends to get on, you know, right on the rip or right on the fleet. And a lot of the times just kind of venturing outside and just kind of having another perspective on things can really lead to a better situation, you know, a better bite, but also like a, just a more pleasant experience overall, rather than playing bumper boats with everybody else and kind of being the, in the crowd, you're creating your own little scenario there and learning a little bit more while you're at it, rather than just kind of sticking to the game plan that everybody else is doing.
Yeah. And so you have a different pressure as a captain, right? Is like me, right, when I'm out as a recreational angler. And so,
yeah,
I know if I'm out by myself or friends, or when I say out by myself, it basically means no camera crew. I've really gotten into loop fishing. So, like, I'll run to Nantucket and back from Falmouth. That's like a 23-mile run, say, to where, like, or maybe 25-mile or whatever, from Falmouth to Great Point, or Falmouth to Monomoy, Falmouth to Cuttyhunk, Falmouth to Nomans, Falmouth to Gayhead, or whatever the run is. And if you think of any of those runs, right, Falmouth, doesn't matter where, but same concept. But Falmouth to Nantucket, Falmouth to Monomoy, Falmouth to Cuttyhunk, Falmouth to, I call it the triangle, the Gayhead, Noman, Squibby triangle, to there. You're running across, and say if it's mid-May through second week of July, you're running over good sea bass territory,
right,
fluke territory, bluefish territory, in striped bass territory. And I would be hard pressed to say or believe that if you did any one of those loops at any point in time, and say, we'll call it the month, like, you know, peak fishing times, you're not going to have a great session. Some spots you'll whiff at, and other spots you'll hit, but you're out of the fleet, you're doing your own thing. And to your point, you become a better angler because you're in different structures, right? In some spots, you're in rock piles, deep boulder rock piles, shallow water rock piles. I define the two with, if it's exposed at low tide, shallow water, deep water is if you're fishing over it at any time. You know, so in our Salty Cape, our new database, we have these terms. But like, so you cover a lot of ground, a lot of species, a lot of little micro seasons. We've cataloged over 40 little micro seasons on Cape Cod. So like striped bass.
That's a good point.
Is like, you know, spring striped bass isn't just spring striped bass. You get the early big fish that are on the big pogies. You get the migrators, the small fish, which is a little alarming right now how few small fish there are. But, you know, they're on the small bait and they come in the roves. And then, you know, you have all these little micro, you know, 2 week sessions that roll up to the whole season. And that's what's so interesting to me about those loops is you get these core samples of all these different types of fish and different types of structures and their own little, you know, seasonal patterns. Mm-hmm. And one thing I will say doing that is I'm not raising my cortisol by saying, why the heck did that guy do that? Look at this guy. How does he, you know, like all the stuff you say when out there, I'm like, I won't do it. It's not worth it to me. And
you're a little more tuned in on what you're doing.
And if I catch 30% fewer fish on a loop than if I just went to the fleet of 600 boats, like pinned in one spot, like fine, you guys can have it. And I have the angler that has the most fun as far as recreational angling is concerned is the guy that is the best angler. That's the point. Right. And, where I'm at in my fishing career is I like little like adventures, the hunt versus the catching the fish is the affirmation. You got all the stuff right.
Right. Yeah, and I totally hear you to your point about, you know, rec versus like in my situation being a guide and, you know, the pressure of putting people on fish. But I think that You know, it's all part of the experience as well as part of the fun, and kind of showing people the diversity of our fishery is a lot of fun for me. You know, whether we're going to start the day targeting stripers on the rips, let's say, or, you know, then switching gears and going, throwing some plugs in the rocks or going to jig some sea bass or fluke. There's a lot of different opportunities. And, you know, myself, when I fish, I really enjoy kind of like the hunt, like you said, you know, really not trying to put up numbers, but catch fish in cool situations, you know, maybe where I can see them and sight cast to them, whether that might be on a rip or in a boulder field or on a flat spin or fly. It's all just kind of that overall experience on the water for me. And, you know, that's kind of why I think a lot of us really enjoy striper fishing. Because it does lead to a lot of other opportunities around here. You know, it leads you to some bluefish and sea bass fishing and stuff. But, you know, striped bass fishing in general just kind of puts you in a lot of different scenarios and helps you really, or helps me anyways, and other people I know enjoy their time on the water in like a pretty vast array of situations. So, you know, it's kind of why I try really practice catch and release with stripers and, you know, I'm passionate about conservation and making sure we have those fish for the future. Cause I feel like they really are the pinnacle of the experience here in New England for rec anglers and, you know, really for a lot of charter guys. I don't think most of us would be running charters if it wasn't for striped bass here.
Oh, you couldn't do it. I remember, what would this have been? 1986 or 1987, mm-hmm. somewhere around that. Don't ask me why I remember the years, but it's important, the timing. My dad had a 24-foot Grady White and kept in Green Pond, and I was just messing around with my freshwater outfit. It was a little like, Rapala made these great, all kinds of great little like one-off. The classic Rapala is just an amazing lure, but it was like the little fat one. I forget what it was. It's killing me that I can't remember the name. And it was short and fat, like me at the time. And I was just messing around with that in the boat in the slip. And I caught like, call it a 22, 20-inch, schoolie, very much a schoolie. And striped bass were so rare then that I was in the front page of the Falmouth Enterprise with it.
Wow.
Like it was such like an unusual catch. Like yeah. Mike Hogan, 10 years old, whatever old I was, caught a striped bass in Green Pond. You know, like it was like groundbreaking. There was no striped bass then. Like maybe if you went in hardcore in like May or October and you're like trolling eel skin plugs at, you know, there was just no striped bass.
Yeah, Joe, I remember Cadero, that well.
Yeah, and Joe Cadero, he was like the greatest striped bass fisherman of all time. And, you know, 24 brown owl, beautiful, beautiful brown owl. Mm-hmm. I have a brochure of his where it was so bad, he ran bluefish charters, even changed the color of the brochure to blue. So you and I both saw a time where like there was like no striped bass.
Yeah,
I mean, it was like a thing, like if you went out at 4 a.m. and you could catch them, but it was like,
it was rare.
It was like catching a sea run brown trout or something.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
No, literally. Like
And so I saw that and I remember, so I graduated high school in 95. By the time I graduated high school, went from zero to, you could definitely catch striped bass in June and early July. Like mm-hmm. that was cool. And then from there on out, it just kept getting more and more mind-blowing through, again, like we were saying, 2006. And so these fish are so cool, as you're saying, like they're on flats. You can sight cast them like bonefish or tarpon. Yeah, you know, they're deep water. You can jig them like you can jig for grouper. You can troll for them like you can for like tuna. Like it's the every fish. It like does so much cool stuff. You know, sure, there's times where they're easy to catch, but so many times where they drive you bonkers.
Absolutely.
So you have enough of both. And like they, they migrate, they like structure, they behave differently, they like, they're moody, and they're just like the perfect fish. They're easy enough to catch where it's attainable, hard, like tricky enough where like you need some skill. And it's a perfect fish. It's funny, they're good eating, but I wouldn't call them amazing eating. Like if you're really, if you're a top chef and you're really good with like, you know, sauces and, you know, especially some of the, like it's a great vessel for sauce, but the fish itself, I don't, I mean, it's good, but I don't find it amazing.
Yeah. There's better options.
Yeah. And so where, you know, there's plenty of fluke and sea bass, Scott, that's my sleeper favorite fish. I've been saying that for years now.
Yeah.
You see, they're trying to promote as the golden zebra.
I did see that. I saw that article. That was really funny.
and the Chilean sea bass. Yeah. And so, a lot of levels, it's just as a responsible human being, if you're going to release a fish, you should go through all the efforts to like release it properly and respect it. Mm-hmm. But B, where if there's any inkling of doubt on like stock status, like it's a no brainer just to keep it going. There's just like all the reasons in the world to be conservation minded with A, living creatures, but B, anything with a question mark on a status.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that, you know, for those people that want to catch these fish in the future, you know, understanding proper fish handling and just basic conservation kind of practices towards, recreational fishing is the responsible thing to do. I know that, you know, I'm not letting clients take bass home because, you know, it's essentially shooting myself in the foot, but also, you know, I'm just contributing to an already kind of struggling situation here, a bit of a struggle that the species is having. And, you know, just by keeping one or two or however, you know, many fish I interact with annually, not killing any, or, you know, if maybe one's gut hooked, taking it home, but, you know, taking the time to really release these fish so that my post release mortality rate is much lower. And just sharing, you know, with my customers and people I fish with these same practices and helping them understand why it's important and why we need to be a little bit more conscientious of, you know, the approaching this all the right way right now so that we have these in the future and that, you know, my kids can enjoy it, your kids can enjoy it, other people can enjoy it when they're older. It's just having that outlook now is going to pay dividends down the line. And I remember a similar story to you when I was a kid. You know, I used to catch a lot of snapper blues in the harbor. I remember going around throwing a little Castmaster all the time and catching scup and sea robins and whatever else off the dock with bait. And I remember the first striper I caught in the harbor on a Castmaster. And I thought I had a big bluefish on there. And all of a sudden I saw like a silvery striped fish in the water.
What is this?
I didn't even know what it was. And then from there, kind of seeing more over the years and spending a lot of time fishing with my dad out in the islands and kind of watching that return of the striped bass was pretty amazing. And then, you know, the fishing throughout the early 2000s was just obviously memorable, but, you know, pretty amazing how that fishery came back and the way it did. And then, you know, to where we are today, watching the whole thing kind of collapse in on itself and how disheartening that is, because there's a lot of people that think that, you know, the fishing's great right now and they do see little blips of it when those fish are all schooled up and migrating through and whatnot. But, you know, for the kids that are into it today, which I'm glad there's a lot of young guys getting into fishing and it's always good to see, just making sure that they all understand how important it is to handle these fish properly and, you know, spend the time to swim those fish before you release them, so that they can maybe experience what a really robust fishery looks like.
All right. So. And I agree like 1,000,000%. And so I, a lot to unpack there, but so I spent a lot of time at shows.
Yeah.
And there's a few things. One, I have a huge level of faith in the younger generations.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And so they have no bad patterns. to undo. Mm-hmm. And so they're, if they learn the best practices out of the gate, you just don't know any different, right? Like,
right.
And so fishing with a single hook versus two hooks on a plug is table stake. Like, you wouldn't know any different, right? It's like,
yeah,
baseball going, you know, if say didn't exist, but say it used to be four strikes, you're out, now it's three. And like, you started at three, you just don't know any different. And I feel like they're a little more sensitive, like out of the get go for, you know, environmental conservation, that sort of thing. So that's wonderful. So, plus one there, right? And then number two, I spent a lot of time in stores and shows and events talking to a lot of, so I'm a Gen X, I'll be 50 this summer. And so I talk a lot of folks my age, and I'm always surprised at how few folks understand the stock situation for striped bass. Like,
yeah.
They just don't know. They're like, oh, I thought I heard something about that, but I had two good trips last season, then I got skunked the rest. I thought it was just me.
Yeah.
And you know, they just didn't know. And furthermore, they didn't know any of the common best practices with the not holding it by the gills or the set. So just because they didn't know didn't mean they didn't care. With just a couple of minutes of, you know, just this is how you do this, they're like, oh, wow, I had no idea. This is great. Thank you. Like, I'm on it. Like, I'll do it. Like, yeah. So can you take all the hooks off for me here at the store or at the show? And and so I find the vast majority of folks that are, quote unquote, doing it wrong, once you share it, sort of the message in a like collaborative kind of constructive way, most people are like, dang, of course, no brainer.
And, yeah, they pick it up quick.
And that's the stuff. It's funny because I deal with a lot of casual anglers, and then in my fishing circles, I tend to be around a lot of hardcore anglers, and I'm very environmentally conscious and conservation focused. They're two different things for me, but and so I'm around those folks. And so it's easy, I think, for a lot of people to get upset with the state of angling, how people are handling the fish. But where I'm sort of on both sides of the fence, I see, like, anytime I talk to a group of people that didn't understand, they were like, oh, wow, I had no idea. Yes, 100%. Absolutely. And they get excited and like they want to help. And
yeah.
And so and then on the third sort of fork to this, you know, Hoagie, we're one plug away from 100% of our plugs coming in what we call the Hook One platform, and ASGA terms, that would be local singles compliant, you know, where that's just a single belly treble and a flag for the, you know, back hook instead of a hook. It's just a flag.
Yep.
And so we retooled all our products, except for one, the XL Dog Walker, and about midway through this year, just winding down inventory. That'll be Hook One compliant. And the beauty is we're finding the landing ratio is gone up with just a single hook. Mm-hmm. And your hookup ratio, I'm sure it's not as good with smaller fish, but it's pretty amazing. In fact, might even be more big fish when you factor in the landing ratio, because, you know, with the two hooks, one gets hooked one place and the other, they get leverage with their jaw opening it up. You know, for a small change, you're going from some of the numbers have changed, but last I heard it was about 8% mortality with the two hooks to a low to mid 2%. And I want someone to check my numbers. I'm not, you know, they're within that range. Your mortality ratio is one third of what it is with two hooks versus one. And so that I know, that's a safe number.
Yeah, I know Mass DMF did a study, you know, on a bunch of different hook styles, and, you know, whether it was a fly or a plug with a single belly hook and stuff. And they definitely proved through that study that that was a significant factor in lowering the post-release mortality.
Yeah, and I think it's by one third. In some numbers, it's still actually more pronounced than that. And so you go to fishing in a fleet. So say when school gets let out June 20th on a good Saturday at Monomoy, how many boats are there? 500? 800? I don't even know.
Hundreds, and for sure.
And everybody's got, like, between, and Monomoy's a big place. I mean, you go from handkerchief all the way to purses and all the way.
Yeah.
And so, like, just think about that. Like, all those hundreds of boats with, like, dozens of fish. And say if that mortality rate goes, I mean, that's like thousands of fish per weekend when you do the math with, like, in tune and that kind of stuff. And you're still, like, so even if you went from 20 fish to 15 fish with a single hook, which you won't. But even if you did, like, who cares? It's still 15 fish. You know what I mean? It's a lot.
You're still out there catching fish, having fun. And, you know, it's not really all about the numbers. You know, it's more about the experience, like we were talking about earlier. At least for some of us, it is. And, you know, if you can kind of prolong those experiences by being a more responsible angler, I don't see why you wouldn't do it.
Yeah, it's a no-brainer. And our data shows you at worst case scenario lose a little bit of performance with just in plug terms going from a two trebles to a single treble. And a lot of our data shows that your landing ratio of bigger fish is definitely much better, which is that once you're hooked with that single hook. But it's not just rigging, right? And so you've got handling the fish, what's happening on the boat with photos, where your hand is relative to the gills, and if it's a big tired fish in warm water, you know, taking the time to swim it. And so the big thing I noticed from the Mass Department of Marine Fisheries is, because what did you track? How long you fought it? How long it took you to de-hook it and release it? Blood, hook placement, and swim vitality? I get all the points.
I'm pretty sure those are, you know, most of the points right there, if not all of them.
And having logging them, the amount of time it took me to, and I've mated on charter boats. I've mated on bluefish party boats. I've run charters. I've run all kinds of, like, so you can tie me in de-hooking fish speed, but not many people are going to kick my butt. You'll say it that way.
Right.
And my average release time with just the single belly was like 14 seconds. Because I did a lot of them for the citizen science program.
Yeah.
And I couldn't get it under 48 seconds with two trebles in the fish.
Yeah.
That's a huge amount of time. And that's me, right?
It is.
And so my friend Jeff, who lives down the street, he has a cabin style Grady White high gunnels. The fish is coming in a net. Now you got two trebles hooked in the net, and maybe someone that didn't work on a charter boat until he's old enough to run a boat and then run a boat. You know what I mean? Like, I think a lot of these fish with these two treble hooks, Monomoy, I think thousands of fish, and that's maybe what the Mass DMF study didn't capture, is how many casual anglers are taking 2 or 3 minutes to, like, unhook and release these fish. And, which it's going to take what it takes to de-hook the fish. But so in one part, it's the single hook speeds that up by a huge percentage of time. Mm-hmm. And I think with the two hook thing, they were talking about that a lot of that study had to do with that second hook placement, where on the larger plugs we're all using now, that back hook lines up perfectly with the gills.
Yeah.
But, time out of the water with the two hooks is really a big deal. And so if you do have a tired fish, you know, fine. It took you a while to de-hook it. You've got kids, you got pictures. Okay, fine. Like, fine. But if you're going to take that amount of time to, you know, do that, or say it happened, it's not a good practice, but say it happened, it's a good practice to swim that fish alongside of the boat. And by swimming the fish, right steps, you're going to keep the boat in gear, person at the helm while the other person leans over and sort of swims that fish.
Yeah, it keeps some water moving over its gills. And, you know, rather than just, you know, unhooking that fish and launching it back in head first, which I see a lot of, and it's not the way to do it. You know, it's like, think about if you ran a couple hundred yards full speed, and then someone said, hold your breath for a minute and a half now, and then you get to go again. You know, if you don't, I don't even know if I could hold my breath for a minute and a half after I ran that long, but if I did, then I would definitely need like a few minutes to kind of regain my focus and get my breath back before I could do anything, I'm pretty sure. So thinking about it that way, these fish are fighting for their life essentially on the end of the line. And then you're taking them out of the water for photo ops or dehooking and this and that. And then, so that whole time they're basically going without oxygen. And then you chuck them back head first into the water and you know, think it's all good.
It is because it goes away from your field of view, doesn't mean it's up.
Right. You know, and I see wreck guys and charter guys throwing these fish back in, launching them off the side of the gunwale. And it's like, you know, if you want any sort of future with these fish, it's definitely the time to be have a little bit more wherewithal about how you're actually handling them.
Yeah. And my rule of thumb for swimming a fish is when that fish becomes difficult to hang on to with your thumb lightly, I just hang on to it very sort of lightly.
Yeah.
And if so the tell number one is the dorsal starts going up and down.
Yeah.
And then I feel light clamping on my thumb. And then the head, then it starts becoming increasingly difficult for me to hang on to the fish.
Mm-hmm.
And then once it feels a little hard to hang on to the fish, I call it the Tommy Boy convertible, you know, where the deer just like came back to life. It was greatest scene. And yeah. And that's my same rule with tuna. I'm not lipping them with my hand to tuna, but you sort of see the same sort of progression. Once like you can no longer manage the thing, that fish has got enough oxygen back in its blood and low enough whatever it is, lactic acid in their blood or whatever. Like, but mm-hmm. So you're just giving them oxygen through their gills, just enough time to like you were saying, catch their breath and just sink to the bottom and then not have any more water to push through their gills to reconstitute their program.
Yeah. And with them having a little bit more energy too. I mean, you know, last year I saw a lot of sharks in shore, brown sharks, and I had some fish eating boatside when I'm going down to grab them. And you think about when you throw those back in certain situations, not all the time, but you know, maybe they're down there and they become easier prey for brown sharks, or you know, if you're up by Block Island, there's a variety of sharks that are out there now. So and just seals. Thinking about, yeah, seals, sharks, just thinking about that along with the fact that you want them to just swim off strong. So they have a chance anyways. But yeah, I think that everybody can kind of, you know, learn a little bit more if they don't know, you know, about how to handle and release fish properly. And, you know, you can learn about that on the ASGA website. There's info about that on your website.
Yeah. Any Salty Cape TV, Salty Cape, our production, content production side of the business, since 2 years ago, definitely not just last year, X amount of time, but certainly ongoing. Every video we have, fight the fish quickly, land the fish quickly, try not to take it out of the water. If you do take it out of the water, never just hold it by its jaw. We didn't touch on that. Where, mm-hmm. you know, you don't want them to, like, you know, dislocate their jaw just by vertically hanging them by the jaw.
Yeah, it's a heavy fish, you know.
Yeah, you want to support it. And then make sure your arm or anything that you rest them on or wet, if they're going to rest on a surface, make sure you have a wet surface. But if you do take the fish out for a photo op, you're going to support it fully so their guts so they don't, you know, like, you know, internal injuries. And quick, place it back in the water, swim it, let it go. And it's less than 25% of the time to dehook it with a single belly on the treble. And then any little casting jigs, I feel like it's a no-brainer with how good the inline single hooks are with landing ratio, hookup ratio, anything like that. You really, you know, between a single hook on a casting jig, an assist hook on a vertical jig, or a, you know, a I use a belly treble with the barb smash down. Mm-hmm. A lot of people use either a single inline or two inlines. Two inlines, I always end up feeling like I'm going to get hooked. But I like having just the one hook on the lure so the lure's a handle. So I can control them
quickly. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. Yeah, and you're protecting yourself as well. You know, reaching down and trying to grab a fish if you're not using a net, which I don't have a net on my boat. I don't have the space, and I don't like putting fish in the nets and then trying to get them out of the net on the deck. It's just, you know, another way to damage the fish. But when I reach down to grab these bigger fish, and they have in the past had, you know, two trebles on that plug, it's a hazard. And I've had trebles buried in my hands and had to, you know, work a hook out of my hand in the middle of a charter. It's not the most pleasant thing. No. So it's safer for the angler, safer for the fish. So it's kind of a no-brainer.
And from a dad perspective, you can promote self-sufficiency with kiddos.
Yep.
Much sooner in the program.
Yeah.
With a plug with one treble versus two.
Right. They can actually get a hand in there.
Yeah. You can accelerate that, de-hook your own fish by years with a single, I mean, obviously you got to be careful, but it's, you know, it's a lot easier for young anglers to handle a fish, new or novice anglers. Same deal.
Yeah, you can have a little more confidence of putting your hand down there and knowing you don't have a secondary hook swinging around that might end up in your wrist or your arm or somewhere in your hand. Or your
face.
Yeah. So, you know, a lot of good stuff to learn there about fish handling. And, you know, what are you kind of looking forward to the rest of the season here?
Well, so I mentioned earlier, I've been like really gravitating to what I call loop fishing. Like an endpoint and back and forth. You know, I'm a little casual with my program, but I'm still leaving the house at 3 a.m. And, but I like exploring. And, you know, it's funny. I try to fish as much like my customers as I can. And I have a lot of different customer groups. So, you know, that's interesting from my perspective. You know, we have entry anglers to all the way to, like, you know, like Ray Jarvis here, you know, uber advanced, like charter anglers. And we got, you know, one of the best in the area right here on the podcast. And so I like running the program, but, you know, you talk about striped bass and mention that, you know, stock status, you know, maybe isn't ideal. You know, one tell is how few small fish we're seeing. Like, you know, I'm not a fishery scientist, but I know if there's no babies, there's not going to be any grownups. That's simple math to me.
And yeah, that's been abundantly clear that we have a problem there.
Yeah. And so you'll notice if you track the hoagie lineup, each year we have fewer and fewer striper lures and more and more we have a whole category that we like to think we invented, the term tactical ground fishing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a whole line of ground fish jigs and ground fish teaser rigs and that kind of stuff. And, you know, as striped bass get the peak fishing windows, and that's really what we're seeing. We're seeing plenty of peak fishing with stripers.
Yep.
You're seeing, like, in fact, anything, I feel like I've had more epic days in recent years, but they're like a handful of epic days and then a whole bunch of like super quiet striper days. Right. And so the time under the integral, but the having less time and grade striper fishing, you know, from a business perspective, to me, that's focus on tuna, focus on ground fish, focus on albies. And thank God, Albies and Bonito. And Bonito has been, you know, like a positive, like, ray of sunshine. You know, who knew how many it could be. And Bluefish, I don't understand what's going on with them, but as much. But so with our business, and it's really tracking with how our anglers are fishing, our customers, we respond to business. But it's not, but their customers are responding to the fishery, right? And so a whole bunch of striper lures like go like crazy peak weeks, and then it like gets quiet. And then groundfish goes, and then albies go, bonito and tuna and that sort of thing. So I can show, you know, stable sales with a drop in striper lures and an increase in other lures. And so on one hand, I just fish with what's available. Like, you know, to me, there's two types of anglers. You have the the experience based angler and the outcome based angler, sort of like a Myers and Briggs type thing and this other. And so I'm absolutely an experience based angler, and I would say most fly anglers, for example, are experienced. You know, like nature, I'm into all the stuff, and you know the loops, and then the outcome. And so if you're focused on how big, how many, and peak fishing, and there's fewer striped bass, you're going to focus on sea bass or fluke. Or you know, people are running like 30 miles to go fluke fishing now. Like,
I know, it's crazy.
And I got really into cod fishing. Really hoping the regs change on that, because I've been tinkering with targeting halibut out east. You know, like
nice.
And so part of it is me just curiosity for new species, but I don't even know if I want to admit to myself how much of it is responding to the change in what's available to me.
Yeah.
And that goes back to the striper thing. So, and by default, I'm a very positive person, and I'm a half full kind of guy, and I'm really struggling here to have a, you know, positive message, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. On my side of things too, it's, you know, we have those peak striped bass moments in parts of the season, and, you know, definitely points and, times where we can target them and catch some really nice fish and have those epic days. But, from my side of things, it's been important to get people excited about the other fisheries that we have. The hardtails that we have from late July through, you know, really end of October, early November. And then also getting people psyched on the ground fish opportunities we have with black sea bass and, you know, even local flounder. And I, you know, on a lot of my trips, rather than keeping a striper, we'll go jig some sea bass and, you know, doing it in a fun way where we're using light tackle, light rods. We're not using bait. We're using, you know, more often than not, honestly, for sea bass, I use your 1 ounce squino jig or 1 1/4 ounce, whatever it is. That's like by far my favorite sea bass jig, period. Cause it's, you know, the right size. And those fish, you know, it basically matches the size of their mouth, and they can inhale those. It's got a single hook on it, and it's a lot of fun putting a jig down there.
And with that deep belly.
Yeah.
They never swallow that hook on that lure.
They don't.
It's always right between the eyes. It's amazing. Yeah,
it is. And it's just a fun, effective way. And, you know, I've ended a lot of trips where we go jig a bunch of sea bass and people are like, wow, that was a blast. And they fight hard. You know, if sea bass got to 20, 30 pounds, you just might as well call it a New England grouper at that point. I mean, they're a hard fighting, fun fish, especially on light tackle. And then we have, you know, as things kind of have made a little bit of a move to the east and the north, where like Boston's seeing sea bass and tautog and stuff now. Down here, we're seeing other species start to show up. We're seeing like, you know, mahi and Buzzard's Bay and certain kinds of jacks that show up in that later part of the season. And, you know, we've had other opportunities arise, even with the wind farm offshore. Every one of those pilings has become basically an offshore reef that holds all kinds of life. So I've been exploring those on charters, you know, whether I'm kind of hitting the close ones on an inshore trip or on the way in from an offshore trip. We hit the windmill bases and kind of discover a new and interesting species showing up in our area.
Yeah. And the Cape is a neat place, right? Cause you've got the northernmost migration of a lot of species, mm-hmm. and you've got the wall that the Labrador current coming down and bouncing off the Cape, sort of the same way the Gulf Stream bounces off the Cape, both pushing east. There's all kinds of different terrain. And I noticed you didn't say cod and haddock and halibut out there.
Yeah, we don't have those down here.
Yeah.
I mean, and, maybe a few cod here and there, but.
Yeah. I got some numbers at Cox's for you, but the. Some secret numbers. But it's so funny to me, like offshore, how many people will troll around all day, get skunked or do whatever. And like right under their feet is like, you know, like, I mean, I would, it's funny, especially out east, like east of Chatham. A lot of those cod and haddock, whenever I clean them, I'm of course curious to see what they're eating. They're all loaded with crabs. That's why our beaky teaser, they're like this pinkish crab, like pinkish reddish crab. That's why all our, it's like, you'll see a lot of pink in the teaser, the olive and pink in these little crabs. And, you know, a freshly properly handled day boat cod, like, you know, tuna is obviously the holy grail eating fish, but I don't know. It's a run for its money in my book. You know, same with sea bass. And, you know, I joked earlier about the golden sea bream with sea scup, but like,
oh man, scup are so overlooked.
I have numbers for like, you know, my most secret numbers are like my big scup numbers. It's funny. I'll tell anybody where I caught a tuna, but like I'll lie about the scup. But, you know, like those big, huge honking scup, they're amazing. And I make sashimi with them, and, and they're one, they sort of almost have like a popcorn kind of flavor to the meat. It's very unusual and delicious.
Yes, it's sweet and white meat, and it's, you know, they're great eating fish.
Yeah. And, let the bass go and keep all the good stuff. I mean, you know, the, whether you're making sushi or fish tacos or, you know, fish chowder, you know, sea bass, I use the sea bass frames a lot to make fish chowder. You know, there's just so much neat stuff. And you can fish pretty much through the summer doldrums if you know where the deeper water humps, and you know, you're passing some beautiful areas, like in your case, you're going by Cutty Hunk and Gay Head and lots of really interesting routes. And early morning, I'm imagining that's when you're plugging for big striped bass and then coming home with dinner, you know. It's a neat program.
Yeah, no, that's a good way to look at it all. We definitely have a lot of variety, and you know, there's definitely better eating options out there, so don't overlook those scup and those sea bass. And honestly, if you haven't eaten a sea robin, give that a try. Those things are delicious. A lot of people look at me sideways when I say that, but until you try it, you know.
I made a bouillabaisse last summer where I did it with sea robins. It was amazing. And there's not a lot of meat on them. You need a lot of sea robins.
Yeah, well, we catch some big ones, and you know, they're pretty much all head, but they have that tail that's pretty much all meat. So
yeah,
that's where the good stuff is. They're like a little, yeah, little micro lobster kind of, and they have a similar flavor. I swear, it's kind of like similar texture and
yeah, a little chewier. They're eating little crabs and periwinkles, and you know, like fish that eat, I call it crustalicious. If they're eating a lot of like crabs and stuff on the bottom, the meat's going to taste good.
Yeah. Lots of crustalicious options out there. So I think, you know, we've covered a lot, and I think that our crustalicious conversation there is a good segue to call it an evening. And I think we've kind of talked everybody's ear off here, but we've covered a lot of good stuff, and it was really interesting to learn, you know, more about your history and development of hoagie lures and how you've kind of come to be where you are today, and your outlook on conservation and all that. So I really appreciate you taking the time to talk us through all that and inform a lot of our listeners, and you know, just get people excited about doing that loop and eating some different species and getting out in the water.
Yep. And having fun's the most important part. So
yeah, and, absolutely.
Now's the time. We got a little bit of wind tomorrow. It lays down, but hopefully everyone's getting out. Fishing's really good.
Yeah. Well, Mike, thanks again. Really appreciate your time and, you know, taking the time out of your evening to get on here and talk with us. And I'm sure everybody's going to enjoy this episode. And you can definitely keep a lookout for some more upcoming episodes. We have some more exciting guests lined up, and we'll see if they can top Mike Hogan. So thanks again, Mike.
Really well. Hey, Ray, thanks so much for having me. Looking forward to fishing.
Yeah, let's get out there soon.
All right, take care.
All right, you too.